Welcome to Dangerous Wisdom, a journey into mystery and a gateway to the mind of nature and the nature of mind. This is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, happy to be here with you so that together we can create a culture of wisdom, love, and beauty. Auspicious interbeing to you and yours, my friends, Kuinos Hermes, deep bow of gratitude and reverence to Sophia. Last time we began contemplating the way of the wolf. If you didn't listen to the first part of this contemplation, it might be better to go back and start there. In this episode, we will consider the credulity of humans and the honesty of wolves. And we will draw closer to the secret of how we can enter into the way of the wolf to experience the wisdom and the magic wolves and other wild beings can put us in touch with. For all my horse friends out there, this secret is part of the way of the horse, too. We could just as easily be talking about horses here. Wolves and horses have their own unique magic, but they also have a lot of overlap. What would wolf wisdom be if it didn't resonate and overlap significantly with horse wisdom? Wisdom means wisdom. For the world to evolve, we must cultivate those qualities of mind, its evolution depends on. Horses, wolves, and other spiritual keystone species can help us do that, especially if we let the holistic education of the wisdom tradition support us. In our last episode, we considered wolves as a spiritual keystone species. We have considered the horse as a spiritual keystone species, and we can learn a lot from both wolf and horse as archetypal currents in the soul. The wolf is part of the mandala of the Dangerous Wisdom curriculum, and the wolf becomes part of the life of anyone who learns that curriculum. We reflected on several passages from a wonderful book called The Philosopher and the Wolf. The subtitle of that book is Lessons from the Wild on Love, Death, and Happiness. That gives you a good sense of the philosophical content. I mean, that's the whole shebang, isn't it? We left off with a suggestion that touches on something we all sense, an idea as old as philosophy, that the story of The Matrix, the movie The Matrix, somehow conveys an important truth, and that in some way we live like sheep, or like potentially wild beings who have gotten trapped in a cage of domestication and conquest consciousness. The essence of wolf spirit comes across in how real wolves face their cage, how wildness faces the attitude of manipulation and control that so characterizes a certain style of human consciousness. Recall that during the reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone here on Turtle Island, aka North America, Yellowstone is a national park in the United States. The researchers worried that the wild Canadian wolves might try heading back to Canada. So for several weeks, they kept them in massive cages referred to as acclimation pens. Now, a lot of those wolves accepted the situation. Wolves are willing to practice some patience, check a situation out. But three of them smelled human manipulation and control, and their wildness sought to teach us all a lesson. One of those wolves jumped high enough to grab onto an overhanging section of a fence that was 10 feet tall, and he then managed to curl his body around that overhang and escape. He wouldn't leave his friends behind, though. After he got out, he dug back in from the outside. That's loyalty. Now, as they sought a way out before that wolf managed to climb over that fence, incredible feat of athleticism and spiritual concentration, But before that, while they were trying to figure out how to get out, those wolves chewed on the chain link fence that they were trapped in. They were looking for any possible weakness, and they threw themselves into testing that fence. And that ruined their teeth. Doug Smith, the lead wolf researcher at Yellowstone, told Carl Safina that he thought they were doomed because of those ruined teeth. But as the researchers observed those wolves in their life after their wild escape, no one could tell there was anything wrong with them. Now, we know the wolves didn't need to ruin their teeth, so to speak, but they were willing to. And perhaps even more importantly, they did not let their damaged teeth stop them. They kept on going, like nothing actually bad had happened to them. And that's perhaps the most important total lesson. That everything about these wolves teaches us that we never have to give up. That there is something unbreakable in us, and that every life situation is workable. Wolves embody a particular kind of wisdom called the wisdom of equality. That wisdom reveals to us that each being, each moment, each situation has a fundamental goodness and workability, even if our mind so often covers that over. As the great mythologist Joseph Campbell put it so well, every failure to cope with a life situation must be laid in the end to a restriction in consciousness. Our limited consciousness is the only cage we're ever really in. That's the message of Plato and Buddha, too. I would say it's the message of most sages. It's a message we see portrayed in the film The Matrix. And we ended our contemplation with a question. Would we rather be sheep or would we rather be wolves? Now, it's a silly question in some ways, but let's be clear that it has nothing to do with becoming violent and aggressive. In some ways, it has to do with the opposite. Recall what Mark Rowlands wrote in his book. He wrote, "I am concerned with the stories we tell to distinguish ourselves not from each other, but from other animals. The stories we tell about what makes us human." Now, I like that line from his book because I often notice, it's just something that leaps out at me all the time when people express human exceptionalism. It's what makes us human. This is what makes us human. Again and again and again we see it. We see it so often. This assertion of human privilege. And we have this lie in our culture. The lie of the big bad wolf, the wolf as evil. But wolves aren't evil. They are capable of as much dignity and nobility as we are. Moreover, they can inspire and teach dignity and nobility in us. Indigenous cultures know this. In his book, Mark Rowlands shares a story from indigenous culture. He credits this story to the Haudenosaunee. Now, I'll tell it the way I heard it, which is a little different from the way he tells it in his book. In this story, the people need to move their village. And they have a long discussion about where to move because the Haudenosaunee had an actual democracy. Many indigenous people have functioned and many still do function on the basis of consensus rather than compulsion, and they don't believe you should force people to do things. So everyone got together to debate. They arrived at a final decision and began all the necessary preparations to move. They're moving the whole village. Everything had to be packed up. Now, as they prepared to leave, a young man returned home from a journey. He had missed all the discussion. Maybe he was on a vision quest. Maybe he was on an important journey for some other reason. But when he came back, he found out that the decision had been made, and he asked, well, where are we moving? And when he found out where they planned to move, he said, that won't do. People said, why not? He said, because that place is sacred to Wolf. So he went to the elders and explained the situation, and they said, well, the decision has been made. Wolf will have to accept it. And the whole village moved. But soon after they settled in, trouble began to emerge. The hunters found game scarce. They thought they had moved to a place where there was plenty of game. They couldn't understand, but then they started to understand. They began to realize that the wolves were actively chasing game away. And when they did get lucky and have a successful hunt, the wolves would come into the village and steal the meat. And then the wolves began to terrorize their children. So the people gathered in council again, and the leaders asked, what shall we do? And one among the people stood up and said, well, we could kill all the wolves. But an elder spoke up and said, well, we might try to do that. Maybe the wolves would win the battle. Or maybe we would win. But if we did win, what would we become? What kind of people would we become if we killed all the wolves? And so the people agreed that they would have to choose another place to live. After that experience, in all their future discussions, they began their deliberations by asking, who will speak for Wolf? In relation to this story, it seems important to emphasize something different about hearing that story in the context of the dominant culture. In the dominant culture, this story should bring out the nature of conquest consciousness itself. And it should prompt us to ask, what have we become? And what might we become instead? That seems to be what this story should point to. When the people ask the question, what would we become? For us, that question has to do with conquest consciousness. It's like the story is warning about the path that we took in the dominant culture. And we have to recognize in general that conquest consciousness tells one story at a conscious level while something else is going on at a deeper level. That means we can't believe the conscious level story. Rowlands raises this issue in the first passage we considered in part one about the wolf. This issue of our willingness to engage in self-deception and to let our stories maintain and perpetuate our self-deceptions. Now, this is a general human challenge, these things that we're talking about. And the current dominant culture is not the only culture ever to suffer from conquest consciousness. So it's not about a particular culture or particular skin color or anything like that. It's a style of consciousness. And the problems of human credulity and self-deception are general human problems. But in the dominant culture, you really have to ask these questions. And it really helps to ask them in relation to wolves, especially today. What's the conscious level story in relation to wolves? For a lot of people, the conscious level story is that the wolves are the problem. That the wolves are dangerous, and therefore we're allowed to kill them. And one of the easy ways we know that this story lies to us relates to the fact that the giant redwoods in California weren't dangerous. Those incredible trees didn't pose a threat to us. But we almost wiped them out. We killed 95% of them, and more will die. All the birds who filled the sky once upon a time here on Turtle Island, they weren't a threat to us. A bunch of pigeons weren't a threat to us. There were so many birds in North America that their migrations would temporarily block out the sun. And we killed them. We made entire species extinct. And we continue to make species extinct. There were so many salmon in the rivers, Turtle Island, that you could hear the salmon runs 2 miles away. You couldn't put a boat in the water. We killed them. They weren't a threat. So the idea that we kill something and try to exterminate it because it's a threat, that's a lie. We're the problem. But we can't confront that, so we tell stories about the big bad wolf. It's part of our general practice of spiritual materialism. As Rollins puts it in the book, quote, if I wanted a one-sentence definition of human beings, this would do. Humans are the animals that believe the stories they tell about themselves. Humans are credulous animals. End quote. By credulous, he means we are experts at self-deception, masters of spiritual materialism. Rollins thinks wolves embody the exact opposite of this tendency. Wolves have culture. They have stories in an important sense, a deep kind of sense. As Rollins puts it, quote, a wolf talks with his body. They can talk, and what's more, we can understand them. What they cannot do is lie. And that is why they have no place in a civilized society. A wolf cannot lie to us, neither can a dog. That is why we think we are better than they are. That's the end of the quote. That's going to be a charged line, why they have no place in a civilized society. We're going to come back to that. Remember that when we start talking about Gary Snyder. We think we're better than the wolves. And this is a big part of why we're the problem. And we know this. We know we're the problem simply by looking at the state of the world. The whole state of the world, the political mess, the economic mess, the ecological mess, the wars, the famines. And we also know that indigenous people here on Turtle Island, they lived everywhere and they lived with wolves. And that's what this indigenous story tells us. This story tells us that it's perfectly possible to live with wolves, to make that sensible decision. We get indoctrinated with the story that it's impossible. We can't live with wolves. The wolves will eat your children. They'll eat all your food. And every wolf kills 5 elk per day. And they'll kill all our livestock. We get freaked out by these lies. And why do we get freaked out if a wolf kills a sheep or two? I mean, if they eat it, we kill wolves and we don't eat them. But we live in this cage, we live in this matrix where a rancher or farmer can't make a living. And the system is so ridiculous because, of course, we already subsidize the grazing animals in a lot of places. Now, I'm not saying farmers have it easy, but we're already helping out. And that tells us something must be wrong with how we do things. I mean, even just this little piece of it, you know? So many big corporations get involved, and most of these grazing leases on public lands, they go to massive corporations, which then funnel substandard, corporatized, and industrialized flesh into the fast food industry. And horses suffer from this as much as wolves do. Those big corporations would be happy to kill all the wolves and also kill all the horses. And in this context, the small rancher has a lot to lose, and the greedy corporations hate losing anything at all. And all the regular folk are stressed and on edge, So people get more than a little upset if a wolf comes along and takes some food. And we probably have a whole situation to ask about there. Why we've enslaved so many beings and whether or not that's actually okay. Because we have enslaved so many cows, sheep, goats, and so on, and we just keep all these animals for slaughter. A lot of it under inhumane conditions. Now again, we can leave out the small ranchers. And even so, it's a very tricky thing to contemplate, you know. I'm not saying that we should just get rid of what we call animal husbandry. That's what we like to call it. But it's an interesting question. The larger question, though, has to do with conquest consciousness, this style of consciousness we are all indoctrinated into. If you're listening to this, you're related enough to the dominant culture that you speak English, and you're probably in it. I'm in it with you. We're trying to get out of the matrix. It's hard to be anywhere on the planet where we're not involved in conquest consciousness in some way, because conquest consciousness has affected the entire world and has infected, in one way or another, most of the humans. You could say it's infected all the beings. Now, some people maybe somehow escaped some of the more severe aspects of the infection, or maybe their infection is not so bad. Some people may have gotten infected and are starting to get better, starting to heal. We're all trying to heal from it, I think. Most of us are infected, though, and that means we can't see the full nature of the infection, because once it affects us, it changes our perception, it changes our consciousness, it changes everything about our experience. And we have to be able to begin to see the unconscious dimensions. And remember what Rawlins is doing with the wolf, what he invites us to do with him, I think, is let the wolf shine a light into that darkness, that unconscious, our darkness, our shadow. The wolf can help us see the ways in which conquest consciousness appears again and again and again in our life and our world. The style of consciousness that wants to exterminate the wolves is the same style of consciousness that dammed up all the rivers and almost exterminated the redwood trees, and may yet exterminate the redwood trees directly or indirectly. And it's the same style of consciousness that has put plastic, heavy metals, and forever chemicals in our bodies. Almost all of us have got pollution and toxin in our bodies, our bones, our organs. It's the same style of consciousness at work. And that same style of consciousness gets us into things that make us very uncomfortable to think about. And there, too, we have lots of rationalizations and conscious stories that we're credulous about, stories that don't give us the full picture. Like, for instance, all the travel we do. We get on an airplane, we go over to Bali or Thailand or wherever it might be. It's nothing. It's a few hours. And we treat the world like we can do whatever we want. And not in the spirit or the real truth that the whole planet is our home, but rather the relation is the whole planet is our playground and our garbage can. And not consciously. Again, remember, there's this conscious story and then there's something else going on. And some of us don't want to see that all of this is part of the matrix, part of the cage, that our desire for so much travel comes as part of the matrix, part of the cage we're in. Our desire to go to all these different places and all the ways doing so ends up wrecking the ecologies we all depend on. Now, recently, someone was talking about the famous wildebeest migration on the African continent. All the wildebeest came to the river where they migrate every year. Every year they cross this river. And what happened? Well, they came to the river and they stood for hours without crossing. Why would they do that? Why would they stand for hours unable to cross the river? Because there was a whole line of cars on the other side of the river. Hundreds of human beings in cars. And the wildebeests were looking across the river And they saw all these cars, and they didn't know what to make of it. Now, finally, somebody among the wildebeests, one of the wildebeests, decided to go upriver and cross upriver. And the other wildebeest began to follow suit. But then what do you think happened? Well, all the human beings heard that the wildebeest had moved up the river. So they started up their cars and decided to drive up so they could see it and get their Instagram photos. It's an entertainment to us. And as we tell the story, we say, oh, it's amazing. That's what we say. It's amazing. And we feel that we're in touch with the wonder of the world. And there we can see how spiritual materialism takes over even our sense of reverence. We believe the stories that we're telling ourselves. A truer story is that we live disconnected from nature. We degrade the wilderness where we live, and of course also in places far away. Our everyday life is just degrading ecologies. And then we get on an airplane, fly thousands of miles to visit nature somewhere else. And the whole trip and our whole way of life further degrades nature in the process. But we can't see this clearly from within our cage. From within the cage, it seems like a deeply meaningful thing. I went and saw the migration of the wildebeest. And I really think we have to laugh at this. We're so hungry. We want this meaningful connection with nature. There isn't a place where nature isn't. Of course, there are places where the wild is no longer in charge. But nature's all over the place. Social media is part of our cage too, part of the matrix, part of the same style of consciousness, and we believe too many of the social media stories. We kind of believe the whole tall tale of social media itself. And we're all trying to make a living desperately. So we need to have followers, and we need to have this and that, and we have to take the picture of ourselves, and everybody's got to see our curated life, sitting in our car while African wildebeests or American bison try to cross a river. Here on Turtle Island, we've had all these stories about tourists and bison. And the whole thing is so bizarre. We want to be paid just to be who we are. That's the latest, when you really think about it. We want to be paid just to be who we are. And think of the incoherence in that. We can't put spiritual and ecological reality into the economic system when that system functions in total opposition to those realities. Isn't that so crazy that we're trying to do this? Wolves don't live like this. It's not clear anybody should. It's not clear that we can survive if we don't get more sensible. Wolves live where they live, and they take care of that place. They become part of that place. I mean, they are that place. They make it. We talk about placemaking. Wolves make their place, and they let that place make them. And they don't try to get paid for being what they are. They just are what they are. So with Wolf 21 in mind, if you missed last episode, he's our superhero, our bodhisattva. Maybe he was a Buddha, I don't know. But he was a really special person. And with Wolf 21 in mind, and Brennan in mind, with the basic dignity of all wolves in mind, with the basic dignity of all humans in mind, with the basic dignity of the wild and all sentient beings in mind. Let's go back to that passage from Aldo Leopold that we were supposed to get to last time. We had a little too much to consider. And it's been a while. I'm going to read this passage again. And let's consider it together with a spacious mind. I'll let you know when we get to the end. This is called Thinking Like a Mountain. And it comes from his San County Almanac. A deep, chesty bawl echoes from rim rock to rim rock, rolls down the mountain and fades into the far blackness of the night. It is an outburst of wild, defiant sorrow and of contempt for all the adversities of the world. Every living thing, and perhaps many a dead one as well, pays heed to that call. To the deer, it is a reminder of the way of all flesh. To the pine, a forecast of midnight scuffles and of blood upon the snow. To the coyote, a promise of gleanings to come. To the cowman, a threat of red ink at the bank. To the hunter, a challenge of fang against bullet. Yet behind these obvious and immediate hopes and fears, there lies a deeper meaning, known only to the mountain itself. Only the mountain has lived long enough to listen objectively to the howl of a wolf. Those unable to decipher the hidden meaning know nevertheless that it is there, for it is felt in all wolf country and distinguishes that country from all other land. It tingles in the spine of all who hear wolves by night or who scan their tracks by day. Even without sight or sound of wolf, it is implicit in 100 small events. The midnight whinny of a pack horse, the rattle of rolling rocks, the bound of a fleeing deer, the way shadows lie under the spruces. Only the ineducable tyro can fail to sense the presence or absence of wolves, or the fact that mountains have a secret opinion about them. My own conviction on this score dates from the day I saw a wolf die. We were eating lunch on a high rim rock at the foot of which a turbulent river elbowed its way. We saw what we thought was a doe fording the torrent, her breast awash in white water. When she climbed the bank toward us and shook out her tail, we realized our error. It was a wolf. A half dozen others, evidently grown pups, sprang from the willows and all joined in a welcoming melee of wagging tails and playful maulings. What was literally a pile of wolves writhed and tumbled in the center of an open flat at the foot of our rim rock. In those days, we had never heard of passing up a chance to kill a wolf. In a second, we were pumping lead into the pack, but with more excitement than accuracy. How to aim a steep downhill shot is always confusing. When our rifles were empty, the old wolf was down, and a pup was dragging a leg into the impassable slide rocks. We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view. Since then, I have lived to see state after state extirpate its wolves. I have watched the face of many a newly wolfless mountain and seen the south-facing slopes wrinkle with a maze of new deer trails. I have seen every edible bush and seedling browsed, first to anemic desuetude and then to death. I have seen every edible tree defoliated to the height of a saddle horn. Such a mountain looks as if someone had given God a new pruning shears and forbidden him all other exercise. In the end, the starved bones of the hoped-for deer herd, dead of its own too much, bleach with the bones of the dead sage or molder under the highline junipers. I now suspect that just as a deer herd lives in mortal fear of its wolves, so does a mountain live in mortal fear of its deer, and perhaps with better cause. For while a buck pulled down by wolves can be replaced in 2 or 3 years, a range pulled down by too many deer may fail of replacement in as many decades. So also with cows. The cowman who cleans his range of wolves does not realize that he is taking over the wolf's job of trimming the herd to fit the range. He has not learned to think like a mountain. Hence, we have dust bowls and rivers washing the future into the sea. We all strive for safety, prosperity, comfort, long life, and dullness. The deer strives with his supple legs, the cowman with trap and poison, the statesman with pen, the most of us with machines, votes, and dollars. But it all comes to the same thing, peace in our time. A measure of success in this is all well enough, and perhaps is a requisite to objective thinking, but too much safety seems to yield only danger in the long run. Perhaps this is behind Thoreau's dictum, "In wildness is the salvation of the world." Perhaps this is the hidden meaning in the howl of the wolf, long known among mountains, but seldom perceived among men. That's the passage. We asked, what is the hidden meaning of the wolf and the mountain? What is the hidden meaning of our own life? And how can we approach the hidden meaning of our life by listening to the howl of a wolf and learning to think like a mountain? And here we have asked how the thinking of the wolf illuminates the thinking of mountains, how the thinking of mountains illuminates the thinking of wolves, and how the thinking of mountains and wolves illuminates our own soul and the soul of the world. What is the nature of thinking? And what is the thinking of nature? How can wolves and mountains teach us to think better, live better, love better? These are questions of ecological and spiritual thinking. That thinking arises as the ecologies we depend on. And we do not have the perspective of a mountain or a wolf when it comes to these ecologies. To go a little further into the thinking of mountains, we can consider an excerpt from an essay that I can make available online for you if you like. A part of what I want to do with this particular contemplation, though, involves putting part of this essay in dialogue with the passage from Aldo Leopold. This excerpt introduces us to a U.S. citizen who entered into thinking like a mountain, in a spirit of wisdom, love, beauty, compassion, grace, and courage that any of us can cultivate. Now, we do need some advanced training to really cultivate all these things, but this passage shows we mostly need heart. We mostly need a sense of compassion and an openness to the wisdom manifesting all around us. We can't delude ourselves into imagining we can go into the mountains and suddenly become enlightened. Or that we can strike up a conversation with the wolves, you know. But we also shouldn't delude ourselves into failing to notice how nature presences wisdom, love, and beauty at every moment. The teachings of the wisdom traditions exist in the wildness of our world, and they abide in the heart of all beings. One day I could read the whole essay if you like. It's got some good stuff in it. It has a lot of Dogen. That makes it good. He was quite a good sage. It wouldn't take you that long to read it. So if you want, you can contact me for it. Probably take a couple hours to read it out loud. But to read it silently wouldn't take that long. Now, the essay includes several passages from another piece. It's a couple things. The essay has some selections from something that Chris Hedges wrote with Joe Sacco. It's got some passages from Dogen, as I said, so that's really good. And has to do with the thinking of nature, including mountains. So here's this excerpt. When our sensing is alive and alove, what we sense is alive and alove. Wisdom is what works, what actually functions as love and beauty. Wisdom is so intensely practical that we get freaked out when we even vaguely begin to sense this. Why? Because it means that every single thing we do, every thought, every word, every action must become spiritual and in many cases even sacred in order to become practical, concrete, optimally effective, and just plain realistic. Everything we do matters, and that can feel heavy to the ego. Consider the plain realism of Larry Gibson, an Appalachian philosopher living in coal country. He expresses the heart of the matter with directness and elegance. Larry comes from West Virginia. His family moved to Ohio when he was a child. His dad got hurt in the mines and couldn't work there. Larry obtained no more than a high school education, and he worked at General Motors until he had to retire early on disability. He returned to West Virginia, and discovering the terrible destruction there, took a stand for life, for love, for the wisdom and beauty of the mountains and waters. Now here's a passage that comes from a book by Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And the voice here is Larry Gibson. Living here as a boy, I wasn't any different than anybody else. First time I knew I was poor was when I went to Cleveland and went to school. They taught me I was poor. I traded all this for a strip of green I saw when I was walking the street, and I was poor? How you gonna get a piece of green grass between the sidewalk and the street, and they gonna tell me I'm poor? I thought I was the luckiest kid in the world with nature. I could walk through the forest. I could hear the animals. I could hear the woods talk to me. Everywhere I looked, there was life. I could pick my own apples or cucumbers. I could eat the berries and pawpaws. I loved pawpaws and the gooseberries. Now, there's no life here, only dust. I had a pigeon. And when I'd come out of the house, no matter where I went, he flew over my head or sat on my shoulder. I had a hawk named Fred. I had a bobcat and a three-legged fox that got caught in a trap. I wouldn't trade that childhood for all the fancy fire trucks and toys the other kids had. I didn't see a TV till I was 13. Didn't talk on a phone till I was 14.
There was crawdads in the streams down at the bottom of the mountain. I could pick them out with my toes. Now nothing lives in the water. It stinks. Nothing lives on the land. And by the time he returned as a middle-aged man, the land of his boyhood was barely recognizable. His family's 500 acres had shrunk to 50. Coal companies, whose old claims to mineral rights underground, many of them deeded by ancestors who could not read or write, gave them rights to seize the land. The spine of the Appalachian Mountains is being obliterated to gouge out the seams of black coal. The constant daily explosions at the edge of his property, which in one typical week in West Virginia equals the cumulative power of the blast over Hiroshima. Rains showers of rocks down on his property. "I expect to lose my life to it, I guess," he says about his defiance. "I expect somebody scared, you know, somebody who normally wouldn't do anything wrong, seeing me up here by myself because of my belief and my stand, and the fact that they may lose a job. And they got a baby on the way and one at home. They may lose their job. And they had a couple of beers that day, maybe, you know. And they see me. I'm hit, you know. Scared people make dangerous people. They act without thinking. And the industry uses people like that. But if I stop fighting for it, they'll take it. Do you know what it's like to hear a mountain get blowed up? A mountain is a live vessel, man. It's life itself. You walk through the woods here and you're going to hear the critters moving, scampering around. That's what a mountain is. Try to imagine what it would be like for a mountain when it's getting blowed up 15 times a day, blowed up every day. What that mountain must feel like as far as pain, as life. I'm not a highly brained guy here, don't have a lot of education. I just point at the common denominator of things. You screw up one thing, another is going to fall. And if that falls, something else is going to fall. And how much more do we have to fall before we start saying, "Whoa, there's something wrong here somewhere, you know?" Now that's as good as any philosophizing one hears today. You know, it's far better than much of what comes out of the academy. To me, it gives moving testament to the everyday, ordinary, extraordinary love wisdom that abides in all our hearts, in all our lands, even if we have yet to get in touch with it at all, or at least fully in touch with it. This is the inherent clarity of the soul. Dogen's essay continues, echoing the spirit of Larry Gibson's experience. Dogen writes, "Although we say that mountains belong to the country, actually, they belong to those who love them. When the mountains love those they belong to, the wise and virtuous inevitably enter the mountains. And when sages and wise ones live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them, trees and rocks flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. This is because the sages and wise ones have covered them with their virtue. We should realize that the mountains actually take delight in wise ones, actually take delight in sages." The mountains of West Virginia, What remains of them surely take delight in Larry Gibson and others like him. They can delight in all of us. The mountains can delight in our art, in the stillness and movement of our lives together, the brushstrokes of mind, heart, body, world, and cosmos, the coloring of our relationality, the dance of our lives, the creations of every moment, as well as the works of art we make for each other, for sentient beings, for the sacred earth, and the vast community of life. The mountains stand naked in their stillness and flow naked in their dancing. Except for the virtue we cover them in, the virtue they already are. We are naked, except for the virtue mountains cover us in, the virtue we already are. If we did nothing else but care for each other and care for the conditions of life that support us all, then all sentient beings and all of sentient being would delight in us, and we would realize our true virtue. We would all have jobs, for there is plenty to accomplish, and we would all have purpose, for there is plenty to be and to present. Dogen writes, quote, "We should understand that the mountains are not within the limits of the human realm or the limits of the heavens above. They are not to be viewed with the calculations of human thought." End quote. To take care of each other, to delight in each other and take care of the conditions of life, we would have to let go of all our calculating. That's frightening for us because we have gotten hooked on calculative thinking. But calculative thinking is not living thinking, which is non-thinking, the thinking of nature, the non-thinking of our original mind. Living thinking is thinking with life, thinking as nature's functioning. It is the original thinking of mountains and waters. It is our true thinking, Sophia thinking, wisdom thinking, which again we may refer to as non-thinking. This does not mean we get rid of critical thinking, but that we practice and realize it. Now that's the end of the excerpt. We need to go a little further into the issues that it raises so that it can lead us into the heart of the love wisdom of the wolf. And I'd like to do that now. I know some of it may even have sounded a little confusing out of context. You might think, whoa, that's a lot of strange turns of phrase. But we're going to get really clear and precise about how to enter the way of the wolf. I'd love to do that right now, but I recognize that podcast episodes can seem intimidating once they get past an hour, you know? And we've earned a break on our journey. I want us to try to hold in mind the whole mandala of this episode together with the next one. And so I'll release the next one at the same time so you can kind of feel how all three resonate together. There are these little details that might be hard to notice. So even if it seems simple, some of the simple parts, if you listen again, you'll notice, wait, that phrase that was in Aldo Leopold, or that word, he said that word over here and over here and over here. There's a thread that runs through it. It's a tapestry or a mandala. Now, as you breathe between these two contemplations, do your best to hold all these things in your heart and mind. And if you do have questions, send them in. Questions or stories to share that related to anything that we discussed in this little mini-series on wolves or the larger series on ecological thinking, send it in through dangerouswisdom.org. We might be able to bring some of them into a future contemplation. Until then, this is Dr. Nikos, your friendly neighborhood soul doctor, reminding you that your soul and the soul of the world are not two things. Take good care of it.